Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the 511th episode of the Hollywood Reporter's Awards Chatter Podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and for those of you tuning in, this episode is being recorded in front of a live audience at the wonderful SCAD Savannah Film Festival in Savannah, Georgia, which I have been privileged to attend and cover for 11 years now, and which gets better every year. My guest today is one of the great storytellers of stage and screen, which is why it's only fitting that he's here at the fest to collect the Storyteller Award. He's a playwright best known for writing 1986's The Colored Museum and co-writing 1992's Jelly's Last Jam. He's a theater director best known for directing the original Broadway productions of Angels in America, Millennium Approaches and Angels in America, Perestroika, two landmark plays in 1993, and a host of Broadway musicals, including 1996's Bring in the Noise, Bring in the Funk, 2004's Caroline or Change, and 2016's Shuffle Along. And he's a screen director, best known for directing the 2005 limited series Lackawanna Blues and the films Night in Rodanthe from 2008, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks from 2017, Ma Rainey's Black Bottom from 2020, and this year's Rustin, the story of Bayard Rustin, the gay civil rights activist who organized the 1963 March on Washington. Over the course of his career, this 69-year-old has been nominated 15 times for a Tony Award, winning three for Best Direction of a Play for Angels in America, Millennium Approaches in 1993, Best Direction of a Musical for Bring in the Noise, Bring in the Funk in 1996, and Best Special Theatrical Event for Elaine Stritch at Liberty in 2002. He was nominated for an Emmy, Best Directing for a Limited Series for Lackawanna Blues in 2005, and he has twice been nominated for the Directors Guild of America Award for Outstanding Directing of a Miniseries or TV Film for Lackawanna Blues in 2006, which resulted in a win, and for The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks in 2018. The New York Times' Ben Brantley has described him as a brilliant stage director, arguably the best now working in the American theater. The Los Angeles Times declared there are few living talents who could be viewed as much of a New York theater institution. Interview magazine said it would be difficult to overstate his status on Broadway, and Tony Kushner proclaimed that he is the premier theater artist of my generation. And those are just the quotes about his work in theater. There are many more about his work in film. But without further ado, would you please join me in welcoming to the SCAD Savannah Film Festival and to the Hollywood Reporter's Awards Chatter Podcast, Mr. George C. Wolfe. Mr. Wolfe, thank you so much for coming to Savannah.
Glad to be here. Glad to.
Let's just start at the very beginning. Where were you born and raised, and what did your folks do for a living?
I was born and raised in Frankfort, Kentucky. My mother was a teacher, and she later became a principal of the schools. I went to that school. She taught me. It was horrifying. my father worked for the state government, that's that.
For the first 8 years of your life, the town in which you grew up was segregated.
Yes.
You have spoken about wanting to go see a movie, 101 Dalmatians, and not being able to do that because of your race.
Well, my grandmother was this incredibly ferocious figure and who would take on anybody. And I remember telling her that I wanted to go see 101 Dalmatians at the Capitol Theater. And I remember her calling, you know, and them telling her no. And it was sort of startling and shocking and fascinating because it was the first time she'd ever come in, I'd ever see her come into contact with a no. And so that was fascinating. But then it integrated. And then at one point, then when I went to high school, I was editor of the high school newspaper. And I went and convinced the man who ran the Capitol Theater that I should go see movies for free so that I could write reviews. And I explained, he said, but by the time the review comes out, the movies will be gone. But I said, but it's cultivating a love of movies. And so that's what my column will do. And so it was my slight payback
Then
I got to go see movies for free.
I love it.
Yeah.
Let's talk, though. There's a moment you've described over the years. You were in fourth grade, and your, at that time, all black grade goes to an all white class.
But that time it was, it was probably a little bit older. So I got about the PTA and the singing. Well, I think by that time Frankfurt was integrated, but I still went to this black school, which was connected to a university there. And the principal, this woman named Minnie J. Hitch, you told us because we were going to be singing a song. And the lyrics were, these truths we are declaring, that all men are the same, that liberty is a torch burning with a steady flame. And she told us that when we got to the line, that liberty is a torch burning with a steady flame, we should sing it with a ferocity, and that we would shatter all racism in the room. So I literally remember, these truths we are declaring, that all men are the same, that liberty is a torch, you know, doing that.
And then racism was gone.
And racism was gone, exactly. They were all transformed. But it was so cluelessly wonderful for somebody to tell someone that young that if you say words, and if you say them with power and conviction, you can change people. And that sense of potency, of conviction, and language was embedded in me, and it's never left.
When did you see your first theatrical production that was done professionally?
When I was 12 or 13, my mother went to do some advanced degree work at NYU, and she brought me along, and it was one summer. And so I saw a production of West Side Story that was done at the State Theater at Lincoln Center. Then I saw a production of Hello, Dolly! With Cab Calloway and Pearl Bailey.
Wow.
And then I saw a production, as it turns out, from the Public Theater and Mobile Unit, that Cleavon Little played Hamlet.
Wow.
And it was done in Washington Square Park.
Wow.
And it was, and in some respect, each of those three productions had, a lasting impact on a kind of aesthetic.
Right.
And the thing interesting about the Mobile Unit, it was free. And so it was seeing the rawness of that energy of the audience was also very, very, really wonderful and really interesting and great.
So throughout the rest of your time in high school, you were increasingly involved in theater in school. I don't know if it was specific. I think, was it writing, directing, acting? What were you focused on at that point?
Well, acting and directing. And also, it's very interesting because when I went to that high school, I stuttered really intensely. So this is the thing I was talking about earlier. So they decided that I was stupid because I stuttered. And so they called my mother over to the school to say, and they wanted to put me in remedial classes. And she says, are you crazy? No, that's not happening. And so I developed an Evita complex. So I said, by the time I leave this school, I will be running it. And so I was editor, I was drum major, I was the worst drum major since the dawn of time. I was editor of the newspaper, of the literary magazine. I just did all these stuffs just to, you know,
show them.
How dare you dismiss? I could tell, and I never heard the story about them calling my mother over, but I could tell I was being disregarded.
Right.
I sensed it. And I went, no.
So you start college in Kentucky and then move to Pomona in California.
This is thorough.
Oh, yeah. We're doing the whole thing.
Exactly.
What was the idea of going out to California? Was it just to have a change of scenery, or were you already thinking, maybe that's where you go if you want to be in show business.
No, not at all. Look, I'd always dreamed of going to New York. I would watch, you know, TV shows that were set in New York, like the Dick Van Dyke Show. And I remember this is kind of neurotic and crazy, but I was obsessed with Disney, and I wanted to have my own amusement park, but I wanted money. I knew you need a lot of money.
Right.
So I decided that actors made a lot of money. This was when I was 7 or 8.
Right.
And I knew that actors starved. So when I was 7 or 8, I used to practice not eating.
Right.
So that when I went to New York, this is insanely true that, you know, I could deal with it, you know.
Wow.
Little did I know one doesn't need to practice starvation. You just sort of like.
So you graduate from Pomona, go to LA for a little while.
Yeah, to do theater.
To do theater. Okay. Now, theater, as I guess you quickly concluded, is primarily in New York.
Well, yeah. I mean, at one point I did shows and I started to get some good reviews in the LA Times. And then I got called in, I don't even remember, to be a writer on a sitcom. And I said something funny, and they said, oh, he's quick. We're going to have to tie one hand behind his back. And I took that literally. And that's when I went, I'm moving to New York, you know? Time to go confront a whole bunch of other stuff and things, right. I need to learn and get smarter about.
Well, so, okay, you move. It's 1979. You're in your 20s. You move to New York.
Early 20s.
Early 20s. Right.
Very early. In fact, I was 19. I was just 19. Pretending to be 20.
There you
know,
go.
Something like that. Yeah.
You move to New York. There are a number of years then after moving there that were, we can say, lean. You got to put into practice not eating so much.
Exactly.
You said, quote, once, quote, I came to New York to write and direct, and when I got here, a lot of my rage came out, close quote. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's so interesting because in L.A., there's more space, so you know, poverty and wealth are very much so separated. And then in New York, it's, you know, they're next door to each other, and the intensity of the inequity at the time, plus the fact that I had no real power over my existence sort of magnified all of that. And I remember one time seeing this image of this woman in a fur coat. It was winter and eating chocolates. And there was a subway vent and there was this homeless woman sitting there and she had newspaper wrapped around her legs instead of boots. And she was like crazy and was like, and just seeing those two images next to each other, it's the thing about New York. Every single time you step foot outside your front door, you see somebody who is worse off than you, and you see somebody who is living a completely different life than you. So you get instant perspective whether you want it or not.
So in those leaner years, you are teaching a little bit. You're going to get your own MFA at NYU Tisch. In dramatic writing,
dramatic writing and musical theater.
And musical
at
theater.
A double MFA, yeah.
And then there's a opportunity to have a work of yours produced for the first time at Playwrights Horizon,
yes.
Which is a big deal, Playwrights Horizon.
Yeah.
And how did that go?
Well, it was interesting. It was ultimately the best thing that could have happened for my career. I didn't direct it. I wrote the book and I wrote the lyrics for it. And there were things that in the rehearsal process that and also when I first came to New York, I said, I'm a writer and director. And they said, no, you can't do both. You have to focus in on one. And I said, but I can do both. And they said, no, you can't. So I focused just on the writing. So then there were things that were happening in the rehearsal room that I knew weren't right. But in the spirit of rah, 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 getting along and being good guy and all this sort of stuff, I didn't object. And then I remember there was a tornado passing through New York City on the day my bad review came out. So I'm standing on the corner of 95th and Broadway with the winds blowing and I'm reading this hate review And it was so very painful, but it was really interesting because it was very good for me because, you know, I went, oh, if this happens again, if I get another bad review, and of course I've gotten bad reviews, but if it's going to be because it's my vision, because I put every single thing I had on the line. Everybody, we're only in the room to make a very beautiful baby. And if we become good friends as a result of that, that's fine. But we all have a responsibility, the people that you're collaborating with, to do their finest best work, and you have to do your finest best work. And it was interestingly enough, when I was at NYU, the piece that I wrote that bombed, I went, oh, this is going to be successful. And then there was this play that I wrote just for myself called The Colored Museum. And yeah. None of y'all applauded when I said the title of the other thing, Paradise, did you? No. But that's what happened. It was the most interesting thing because I wrote one for success and I wrote one for myself. And that was the thing that succeeded. And so it was a very deeply, deeply, deeply valuable lesson. It was just like, and then 8 weeks later, all those people who tracked, 8 weeks, no, 8 months, like, word that it were 8 weeks. 8 months later, all those people who trashed me were going, where's he been? Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. And it was, I'm so glad it happened that way. I'm so glad that the first piece was treated that way so that therefore it gave me a clarity and a sense of responsibility and doing work that I believed in and that I believed mattered as opposed to something that was going to lead to success. It was just one of those slap you in the face and get smart, George.
So you mentioned The Colored Museum, which let's just say though, you know, you're coming off the rough review. How did you even get the opportunity to do The Colored Museum, which is gonna, as if you don't know, it was the first big success for Mr. Wolf. So how did that opportunity even come out of that?
Well, it came out of that because I was at Playwrights Horizons, because a guy named Lee Richardson, who was running a theater called Crossroads, said, you're at Playwrights Horizons, and I don't think there's ever been a black playwright at Playwrights Horizons. Do you have something else that you've written? I said, well, funny you should ask. Da-da, Colored Museum. And so that's how it happened. So they were both connected in a way that didn't seem so at the time, but was sort of brilliantly perfect.
I want to ask you, so The Colored Museum is produced at Crossroads in 86 and then moved to the Public Theater in 87, which you'll notice the Public Theater, the great off-Broadway institution, is going to come up quite a few times in this conversation. But can you, for people who weren't around at that time or don't know or whatever, can you describe what The Colored Museum is about and what the controversy, backlash that provoked was? Because it was, you had to develop thick skin early on because it was not all fun and games in response to that one either.
Well, that was different. That was called pure unadulterated jealousy. So I came from nowhere, and all of a sudden I'm at the Public Theater, and Frank Rich wrote a rave review, and said it's the kind of playwright who takes no prisoners. And people thought, and that meant he kills people. The language kills them, right. And people thought that meant I was soft. So it was just like that was just dumb cluelessness. That was very easy to dismiss. And you know, and it was just jealousy. I went, oh, my feelings are hurt. Oh, I'm over that. Okay, go to hell. You know, it was just sort of like, I didn't sweat about that.
Well, tell us a little bit about the show, because this was your big success.
It was first. It was interesting. When I was at NYU in the dramatic writing program, there were about three or four people writing plays about old black tap dancers. And they didn't happen to be old black or tap dancers. And so, and I just thought about it and I said, so somebody has figured out, has made a decision, or dynamics have been created so that people have decided what black is. And I'm going, I'm black, I've been black my entire life. And I view it as this ever-changing, complicated, insane, brilliant, amazing thing. So it was an effort to shatter any preconceived notions that I thought were going to stand in the way of what I wanted to create. So I wrote this play, which was 8 exhibits set inside a museum. So I wanted to shatter all the perceptions that were in my head so as to liberate me to go in any direction that I wanted it to. And that's what happened. And it became this, very successful show. It played, I think for 10 months at the Public Theater. Then it went to the Royal Court in London. Then it toured all around. And now it's you know, high schools do it now, yeah, and stuff, which is great. So it's, and then as a result of it, then I started getting interesting from that. I went from, you know, being completely flat broke to then I met the heads of studios. Yeah. I got Mike Nichols wanted me to write a movie for him. Robert Altman wanted me to write movies. So all of a sudden, you know, these job opportunities happened.
But it wasn't for many years that you actually went into film. In the meantime, you were kind of seizing this interest in the theater, this opportunity now in the theater. There was a person who is legendary by the name of Joseph Papp, who founded and ran the Public, who took a great interest in you and, you know, brought you in there. And, mm-hmm. and we can say, you know, in addition to producing the Colored Museum, right, named you one of three resident directors there, offered to have a producing entity within the Public for you. This was a big champion to have. He then passes away in 1991. He gets succeeded by a lady who was there for only 18 months. And then in August 1993, this institution of the sort of first thing that comes to mind when you think, at least for me, off-Broadway, comes looking for a new director. How did you become aware that there was interest in you for that position? And was that job, which you then, spoiler alert, got and held for the next 12 years, was it what you thought it would be?
Nothing is ever what you think it's going to be. But that's the point of the journey. I directed a Broadway show called Jelly's Last Jam. And then I was then offered Angels in America. And then I was in the middle of directing a 7-hour play. And then they called up my lawyer and said, we want to talk to George about running the Public Theater. And I went, well, I'm kind of busy right now. Right. Can they come back after? And they said no. And so they wanted to make a decision. So when I was in rehearsal, it was announced that I was running the Public Theater. I loved about running the Public Theater was giving artists money and spaces where they could go do work. After Jelly, I went, oh, this is hard. Surviving Broadway and dealing with all of the dynamics and the money and the audiences and all of that stuff, this is really, really hard, and you have to be really, really tough. And so I knew all these artists who were really gifted, incredibly gifted people, but maybe weren't as tough.
Can I just mention a few? Because these are shows that were given a spotlight by you in those years, which, in fact, several of them were just revived in the last couple of years. So decades later, people are, you know, coming back to them. But let's note Twilight, Los Angeles, 1992. This was Anna Deavere Smith, and important show there. That was 1994. We had Top Dog Underdog, Susan Laurie Parks, wins the Pulitzer for that, 2002. Take Me Out, again, just revived. So these are the kinds of people who we're talking about, where you can, and this, the Public was not particularly known for its being inclusive prior to your tenure.
Well, I'd say it was, I think probably, yes, I think it's also a place that gave us, you know, for colored girls, and yes, it's also a place that gave us for short eyes. So I wouldn't totally agree with that. And also, these were very smart artists, and these were tough artists, but there were, you know, it's just, you people, when you're beginning, you need a place to play, and you need a place to fail so that you can get smarter, like I had with Playwrights Horizon. You need to do the work and not feel the pressure of it being the biggest hit in the world, because you're growing and you're learning and you're getting smarter and you're getting tougher and you're learning more savvy. Just like the things that I allowed on the first production that was done, I didn't allow on the second one. Right. And so you get, you know, so you're growing all these muscles. You're not, it's not just your talent muscles, it's your ability to defend yourself and to protect your work and to go, I disagree with that. And, you know, I remember one time there was a writer who was doing a play and a couple of things got really wonky in rehearsals. And I said, well, why didn't you speak up? He said, well, I was just scared that I was actually doing a play at the Public Theater and somebody was going to discover I didn't know what the hell I was doing and throw me out. Right. And it's that fear. You have to realize that fear and doubt and all the self, all that stuff is a part of growing. And you have to have permission to grow. And so that's what I took on very much so, which is creating a space that was as, that I wanted the audiences and the artists there. I wanted it to look like the subway at rush hour in New York. I wanted to have all kinds of people there. So that was the thing that I loved. After a while, it became very, very clear to me that as much as I was creating spaces for other artists, it was very challenging to be one.
Right.
And while being in charge.
Well, let's go back to, again, what you were doing when you got that opportunity to go there, because this was the beginning. While you're creating these opportunities for people off Broadway, you were making your first inroads on Broadway. As you mentioned, Jelly's Last Jam, 1992, you co-wrote and directed this about Jelly Roll Morton and the birth of jazz. Your first Broadway show, musical with Gregory Hines, and small role the first time you're working with Savion Glover.
Yep.
And this gets 11 Tony nominations, wins three, and sort of leads to Angels in America. Mm-hmm. Now, this is, it's been looked back at. I think the New York Times looked at it as the greatest show on Broadway of the last 30 years. It's an all-timer, obviously. But you first saw it as a spectator in Los Angeles. It started at the Mark Tabor Forum. There doesn't sound like there was even a thought in your head that you might ever have anything to do with this.
No.
So how did that change?
Well, Jelly had opened up, and I worked with a producer named Margot Lyon, who passed away, who was a very dear friend of mine. And everybody, you know, and there were some changes that were going to be made from the Tabor to when it moved to Broadway. And she brought my name up, and Tony Kushner, and someone called me up and said, Tony Kushner wants to come and talk to you. I said, okay. And he came over and he talked. And I had never read the play. I'd only seen it. So I talked to him about it and just gave him my observations. And then, you know, 3 or 4 days later, somebody called up and said, he wants you to direct it. So it was just sort of, you know, I used to joke and say that my ancestors had board of directors meetings and they would figure out what I was going to do next, because this just literally dropped into my lap, and it was wonderful.
So,
and hard, but good.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and as you say, so initially part one
was 3.5 hours.
3.5 hours. And that was Millennium
Approaches.
Then I guess he finishes Perestroika. That's another 3.5, right?
Well, he also finishes Perestroika while we're in rehearsal for Perestroika.
Oh, my God. So, for anyone who doesn't know, this is biting off, aside from the amount of time, of it's just a lot of subject matter material. AIDS, being gay at that time, politics, Roy Cohn, Angels, on and on, a lot going on there. When you were stepping into that assignment, which had already, this was already a phenomenon in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
There's high expectations, huge pre-sales,
and
everything.
In London. Yeah.
Is that exciting, scary, intimidating? What was your feeling going into that?
Well, it was one of those incredible things, because I was going like, how do you direct a 7-hour play? And I would just went, oh, like anything else, one scene at a time.
Right.
And it was also one of those situations where, you know, I got really basic with myself. I said, George, nobody's paying you to be overwhelmed, intimidated or feared. They're paying you to do the job. So do the job. So get to work and just do the work.
Right.
And so there was no time for, if you do the job, there's no time for self-doubt. If you're doing what you're supposed to do, all that other stuff is just crap, and it just gets out of the way. Just get out of the way, and you push it out of the way so you can do the work and dive into it and approach it with his grit, and also in that case, I felt as also, particularly on part two, I felt as though I wanted to protect Tony because he was doing rewrites so that he could do the work that he needed to do. And I also to protect the actors because the actors were performing part one at night and then rehearsing part two during the day, which can make a person crazy. And it made them all crazy. And so I had a series of jobs to do, right, in a directing to directing and protecting the artists and protecting the work. So,
and starting at the public theater.
And starting at the public theater and all of that. And so it was just, you know, it's a, you know,
you do
it. You got to do it. You just do the job and try to keep his focus and clear and as clean and as uncontaminated as you possibly can in your brain, so that there, once again, fear and all that sort of stuff, those are luxuries.
And of course, once it was up and running, went over tremendously. Record number up to that point of Tony nominations for Millennium Approaches, tons of Tonys, all of that. I want to talk about how this impacted you. Here's a quote from you from a few years ago. Quote, prior to Angels in America, if I walked to the corner and threw away a banana peel, it would be George C. Wolfe, black director. Since Angels in America and the public theater, I am no longer discussed as being black in the press, close quote. Now, this I had read, I can't independently confirm this, but this, there was an assertion that Angels in America was the first really blockbuster Broadway production that wasn't about black subject matter explicitly, that was directed by a black director. I don't know if that's
true. In the history of Broadway, I think that's true.
But so just to come back to your quote, can you expand on how this affected your life and career in that? Because this is as big as it gets.
Well, it was just like if I express interest, you know, I direct Iceman Cometh with Denzel, and the rest of the cast is white. I mean, that's not like trick casting. It's just because he's a brilliant actor, and you just do it. And so I think it shattered. Once again, it didn't shatter anything for me personally. It shattered other people's limited view of me.
Right.
And that's, you know, because then, he does that. Oh, and first it was like an all-black musical that I directed with Gregory Hines, and it was a new one, and it had dark edges to it, and at the same time it was entertaining. And then I did Angels, you know, which was this epic, brilliant, phenomenal play. And then after that, it was, you know, there were still some, but there appeared to be no question of that I could do. I was a director.
Yeah.
And if I loved something, or if I wanted to do something, or if I was interested in something, you know, I would either pursue it or people would pursue me. And, you know, and that's still, you know, film, that was a little bit different.
Well, we're about to get to that, because 2005 is when you took your first steps into filmmaking, or at least that's when the release of the first film was. But before that, there's one last pre-film stage production we got to talk about, and that is Caroline or Change. 2004, you directed, this is a musical about a black maid working for a Jewish family, 1963 Louisiana. And it's you and Tony Kushner again, as well as Janine Tesori. This is like the dream team of Broadway here. You got yourself and those two. That's another show that maybe it was in some ways more polarizing than earlier ones, but people who loved it really loved it.
Yes.
What stands out to you when you think back on that one?
I don't know. It was a fun collaboration. It was the New York Times wrote a dismissive review, which was wrong. which was wrong. It's a brilliant piece. It's an astonishing piece. Tanya Pinkins played Caroline, and it was applause. It was a brilliant performance. The whole cast was just extraordinary. It was, you know, and it was a work that I was very, 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 very proud of, and very proud of Tony and Janine. It's a kind of a true story, and, you know, Janine's extraordinary. And it was just great, hard, good work. The whole team, all the actors, it was a joyful experience.
And just out of curiosity, since you move between musicals and plays, do you sort of reflexively feel more at home doing one or the other, or not at all?
No. Now, this guy that I work with, John Benjamin Hickey, who I work with on The Normal Heart, said to me, and I went, oh, that's true. He said, you direct plays like they're musicals, and you direct musicals like their plays.
The rhythm.
I'm very interested in musicals. Tend to be, that's why I loved Carolina Chase, that's why I loved Jelly, tend to be, you know, I think I love you, I love you, and you just, and you know that you're in love with that person and all this sort of stuff. I was really interested in seeing, cultivating behavior so that you understand what the story, and that's why working on something like Caroline was really great, because it was, they would sing something, but you had to study and key into the behavior the way you do in any play, in a Tennessee Williams play or an August Wilson play or Eugene O'Neill play. So I wanted to bring, I like bringing that sense of texture and depth to how musicals are performed. I mean, I love the buoyancy of it all, and you have to maintain that buoyancy, but I like the texture of that. And actually, strangely enough, I feel like it's probably working on musicals that trained me to direct film.
Perfect transition.
There you go.
Thank you. Okay, so your first film project is Lackawanna Blues. This is 2005. It's adapting a play by an actor turned writer, Ruben Santiago Hudson, that you had commissioned back when you were at the Public.
Because Ruben used to come into my office and run his mouth and tell these incredible stories. And I went, I got a building to run. Here's some money. Go sit in that room and write it down. And he turned it into a brilliant one-man piece. And then HBO was interested in doing it. But prior to that, I directed a show at the Public. And Mostel, Yassine Bey, was a really good friend of mine and had all these projections and all these projections and all these productions. He said, go direct a film. Just go do it. You're doing everything but the film, so go do the film. And then Ruben called me up and said, will you help us out? And I said, sure. And that's how I got involved.
Now, maybe I'm wrong about this, but it seems like while there may be certain similarities between directing for the stage and directing for the screen, there are definitely some different skills also required. I can't imagine that anyone, even a great theater director, can just show up and know stuff with the camera and all of this. So what was the most important assets for you as you were stepping into filmmaking for the first time to just know technically how to do some of the things you wanted to do?
Well, I just made the camera a character. I just made the camera a character. Mm-hmm. And that's how I treated him. I said, I don't know what this thing is, so let him be or her be an observer in this story. So I just turned him into a character. And I would periodically I'd have my theater to film dictionary running in my head. At one point I said, rehearsals in the theater, you rehearse, six, seven weeks, And so I started instituting, I have a rehearsal period.
Which is not that common for screen acting.
But for Rustin, I had a two-week rehearsal period. On Ma Rainey, I had 2 weeks rehearsal. When we were filming on Ma Rainey, Chadwick would come up to me like literally once a week and say, thank God we had the rehearsal period, because it builds confidence. And it also is a time for you to evolve a vocabulary of working with the actors so that therefore, by the time everybody else has showed up with the cameras and everything, they're grounded in a very specific way. So I just, and also I realized that film, you can, your compulsive, insane self can show up and be engaged. I remember I was directing a scene in Lackawanna, and there was a guitar player who was blind, and his eyes had this really beautiful opaque color, and he was having a scene with this little boy, and there was some iced tea on the porch, and they were talking, and I went, "That iced tea is the wrong color. It's going to upstage his eyes. We got to get rid of the iced tea." And I said, "Make that lemonade." And then I heard people go, "He wants lemonade. He wants lemonade. He wants lemonade." And then the next thing I know, they show up with the lemonade, and I was right. And, but it was just sort of like, it just fed that idea of I firmly believe that everything either contributes to the storytelling or distracts. And so that's that was that once I figured that out. And, you know.
So for a perfectionist or a control freak, film is better because you can.
There's no end in sight.
Right.
No end in sight.
Right.
Whereas when you know, if you're making a change in the theater, when you're in previews, you only have from like 1 o'clock until 6 o'clock to rehearse. Because then the actors have to take over so they can perform that night. And if you overwhelm them too much, they won't have the confidence and the command to do what they need to do, including all the changes that night. So you have to limit it. Whereas with film, you can just, you know, keep going and going and going and going.
Right.
And driving everybody crazy.
So I'm going to bring up a topic that may set you off from what I've heard. People say when you're adapting something from the stage to the screen, as you have done on numerous occasions, you have to open it up. Meaning, it shouldn't look like a filmed play. That's not a phrase you particularly like, right?
No.
Opened up. Why?
Well, because I don't know. I don't think you think about the thing that you should do. That's not a choice. You think about the opportunity of what you do. In Ma Rainey, it was like they spend a lot of time in this, the musicians spend a lot of time in this basement. And I wanted to be claustrophobic and I wanted it to be oppressive. And there's a lot of language flying around all over the place. That's not a weakness. That was a choice that was made. And then there was a moment where Levy, Chadwick Boseman's character, kept on talking about this door and kept on talking about this door. And then at one point, I came up with the idea, well, let's have him at a point where he's feeling his least powerful knock that door open. And he knocks the door open and he goes into a room and he realizes it's just as enclosed. And that was a metaphor for him, for a black man of ambition a young black man of his age in the 1930s. Regardless of whether you think you've escaped one locked room, you end up in another. And so that was opening it up in storytelling ways. And then when they cross the streets, and so you're looking at it. So I look at it as just telling the story as opposed to, and now I have to open up. Right. You know, it was part of the organic process. Or at the end of the film, when he gets tricked out of his songs, you know, in the play ends because he kills the person, Glenn Turman, whose character's name I've forgotten right now. And then all of a sudden, at one point, it came to me. I went, oh, what happened to his song? And then you see, like you see with Big Mama Thornton and Elvis Presley, you ain't nothing but a hound dog. So we get to see the end image is him, an all-white band playing his version of his song and stuff. So as long as you can find an organic way of expanding the world and expanding the universe, then you do so, as opposed to thinking about, and now I must obey this dictum of opening. You know what I mean? Where's the opportunity?
Right.
Breathe inside of the opportunity. Don't breathe inside of some dictum that somebody is saying. And if it succeeds, it succeeds. And if it doesn't, it doesn't. On to the next one.
Right. Well, the next one, first we'll say For Lackawanna Blues. First film, you win a Directors Guild Award and a National Board of Review Award. So not a bad way to start there in a new medium. Then you followed that with the film Knights and Rodanthe. This is an adaptation of Nicholas Sparks. You got Richard Gere and Diane Lane. Then you go back to Broadway for a great production that was not with us long enough, Shuffle Along, which is worth discussing for a moment because I think it kind of goes back for you years earlier. Can you just explain for people what the original Shuffle Along was and why it was important to you to reunite with Savion Glover and bring it to Broadway?
Well, Shuffle Along was done on Broadway in 1920. UB Blake, oh my God, and the brain is going to go blank. Oh my God, what the hell?
Well, you were, I know one of the people involved was Paul Robeson, who you were very...
He joined it late on. Aubrey Lyles, and God forgive me for not remembering your name. But anyway, it was done in 1920 in the summer, and no theaters on Broadway generally performed during the summer because there was no air conditioning. But they came into town with this show called Shuffle Along, and it became this monumental hit. It ran for a couple of years. It was a touring company. And one of the things that's so interesting about UB Blake's parents have been born into slavery. And his dream was to make a Broadway show. And I just found that there's something so poetic and so astonishing that that's what his dream was. And his parents were slaves, and he goes and makes a Broadway show. So that was extraordinary to me. And it became this huge hit. And then when it toured around the country, because it was such a big hit, you know, it started to integrate a lot of the theaters around the country. It made like I think $19 million, which is a lot of money in the 1920s. And it was this huge hit that transformed. Ziegfeld hired the chorus girls from Shuffle Along to teach the girls at the Ziegfeld Follies. It was this huge influential hit. And it's similar but very different than Rustin. I remember I found a copy of a book about hit plays from 1920s, and it had been the biggest hit of 1920. And they had list of all the plays, all the musicals. And they had also mentioned Shuffle Along. And it was just astonishing to me that something that had had that great of an impact got dismissed by history, similar to Pyard. And so I have to tell this story. And the more I got into it, the more obsessed I became.
And so this was you and record 6-time Tony winner Audra McDonald and...
In the movie.
Yeah, back here as well. You have your stock company. You know, but Savion Glover, again, anytime you're going to do dance on Broadway, you got to...
Yeah.
So anyway, that was a special one. But now back to the screen... The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, 2017, which was with, among others, one Oprah Winfrey, returning to acting for the first time in a while. And then 2020, your first of now two collaborations with Netflix, Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, an adaptation of the 1984 play by August Wilson, who died in 2005, meaning you guys overlapped in the business. Did you know each other?
Yeah. August offered me one of his plays, and he said, we met in the bathroom at the Goodman Theater in Chicago. He said, I want you to direct a play of mine. I said, sure. Can I read it? He said, I haven't written it. And so I said, well, I don't know if I have anything to offer until I read it. I could be a bad fit for it.
Sure.
So we talked about it. And interestingly enough, Jelly's Last Jam, which was my first Broadway show, he was the original book writer on that before I got involved.
Oh, wow.
And then he went on to write his 10 monumental plays.
Yes. And
11, you know, count.
And the thing, so Denzel Washington, who you, again, have a longstanding collaboration with, he's the one who has said, we need to bring to the screen all of these August Wilson productions so that they're kind of preserved for posterity. Yeah. And that really kind of began with him coming to you, right?
Yeah.
Well,
he did the first.
Fences was before.
Fences, yes. And then
Ma Rainey. But he says, I want you to be the guardian of this one. You go and get Viola Davis and Chadwick Boseman. And we should note, for people who've just seen Rustin,
Coleman Domingo
as one of the people
and
in the
Glenn
band.
And Glenn Turman,
right. So I guess, you know, we've talked a little bit about the way you worked making Ma Rainey, but you know, a question that I'm sure you've gotten many times, but people will of course be interested. That was the last time we got to see Chadwick Boseman on screen. Was there any discussion that he was not well?
No idea.
There was
the ferocity.
Right.
You know, he was thin, but I you know, we get fat, we get thin. Right. The work ethic and the brilliance of the work and, you know, was just so ferocious. And I mean, the last week of filming was a hateful week because it had three or four of his most monumental scenes. And there was the one scene where he pulls a knife on Coleman in the scene, and there were these steps outside of that room. And after a take, he would just go over there and he'd just be like this. And I go over and I go over and I go, do you have time for some? I said, are you ready for some notes? And he'd go.
Motion to you.
And then I'd give them to him. And then he'd come back and do the scene again with the same degree of intensity. The kicking of that door, we had to, he busted the door. We had to get a repair on the door. So he approached the work with such ferocity and intelligence. And he sent me a script of something that he wanted me to direct. I sent him a script of something that I'd just written that I'd want him to do. So it was all about forward motion, forward motion, forward motion. It's still deeply, deeply, deeply devastating.
Absolutely. Now, the one thing you have said is that there's a scene in which Levy, his character, reveals a scar on his chest. Did you and Chadwick have a chat during that making of that?
We talked about it a lot, and he talked about sharing secrets a lot, and the phenomenon of doing that, and even, you know, I in retrospect I realized what he was saying, but he never said it. He just wanted it to be about the work. I work with Nora Ephron,
right?
On Lucky Guy, her play, and she came to my house, you know, two or three times a week while she was very, very sick, and she said I didn't, and then someone called me up and said, Nora's very, very sick. She's in the hospital. I said, can I go see her? They said, no, she's dying. And she told people in her family, but she said, I did not want every conversation to be about my illness. And I think, you know, people have different ways of dealing. And so you just have to honor and respect them and be blessed for the time that you have where you work with them.
And we're so lucky to have that performance from Chadwick
for
posterity.
Oh, my God. Yeah. It's astonishing. Astonishing work.
This brings us to Rustin.
Yeah.
2023. It has been exactly 60 years since the March on Washington. How long have you known the story of Bayard Rustin, and what made you decide to be part of a film about him?
Well, I knew about him in college. And then when I got involved with the Center for Civil and Human Rights in Atlanta, I really dug into not only the civil rights of that city, but also just in general. And that's when I became sort of obsessed with Bayard.
What fascinated you the most about him?
Well, the fact that he organized something so monumental in 8 weeks is, who does that? And people would say, and his contemporaries said, he was the most brilliant organizational mind around, period. Everybody knew it. Even people who couldn't stand him or who were jealous of him or didn't want him around acknowledged how brilliant he was at that. So that was a huge obsession of mine. Then when I found out that he recorded an album of Elizabethan songs and Negro spirituals, I mean, who does that? I mean, it's just sort of like, it makes absolutely no sense whatsoever, and it's so wonderful at the exact same time.
How about also the fact that at a time when this was a pretty repressed society, this guy was living about as out as you could be, right?
100%, 100%. It's interesting, and I think the Quaker, the fact that he was a Quaker, I think had a lot to do with that in some strange way.
Okay, now there's no special movie if you don't have a special actor to play Bayard Rustin. As great as you are, that's another key ingredient, right? So what made you think of, and we're lucky you did, Colman Domingo?
Well, his name was brought up by a number of people. And I went, oh, okay, that could work. But I was also, I was sort of, well, initially I was called upon to write and direct it, but I was finishing up Ma Rainey where I was writing something else so I could do it. So I was in the process of entering, I was entering into the material. The way I, you know, it's like, if it's a period piece, I try to learn as much as I can about the period, the details, popular culture. I saw Shadows, you know, John Cassavetes' first film, which is strangely enough about race and was set in New York City. Sort of 66, I think it was, Sammy Davis Jr. did A Man Called Adam, and a lot of it was set around Times Square area. And then Sweet Smell of Success, which is a brilliant movie. So I was looking at all the movies from this time period, and it became interesting that a lot of them it happened around the Times Square area. And Arthur Gelb, who was the cultural editor of the New York Times and who was a friend of mine, he said he remembered being standing in Times Square and seeing a policeman go up and hit a black man on the back of his leg saying, "You don't belong here." And it just got, and it just became very interesting to me. Well, where did black people belong aside from Harlem? Where did they belong, and where did gay people belong? And it was on the side. It was 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, the streets where there are shadows. That's why a lot of the scenes, a lot of the scenes between Bayard and Elias are happening in these shadowed areas. So, in some respects, the movie is a journey of, for me, of going from having to exist on the side streets, in the alleys, to taking over Washington, D.C. daylight and claiming that city as your own. Because also Washington, D.C. was segregated at the time. The scene where we filmed the girl being assaulted, the three people at the sit-in, at the time our scout told me this was a segregated place as well in D.C., So I was just in the process of just absorbing all this information, as much information visually and sonically, and, you know, Doris Day and putting Ruth Brown in there and Little Jimmy Scott. And just so it felt like the texture of the period. And then people, somebody mentioned, oh, blah, 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 Colman Domingo. I went, oh, and I go, oh, okay, yeah, okay. And then at one point I just found myself going, oh, Colman could do this. Oh, oh, that would be fine if I hear Colman say that line. And so it just, it, so it became organic. It became a part of the process of my layering in the understanding of how to embody this period. And so his brain sort of joined that process.
And Colman, not that this was required for him to play this part, but happens to also be quite a social activist himself, mm-hmm. I believe. And
yes.
Just a really interesting guy. And
he's a baritone, but he changed his voice to become a tenor like Bayard.
Right. Now, you surrounded him with a lot of great actors, including many of them who have been, again, part of this stock company of people you return to. Some not, but let's just note Glenn Turman again, Audra McDonald again, Jeffrey Wright, who you've worked with probably more than anyone.
More than any other actor.
Right. Chris Rock.
Yes.
Who I believe I just heard is now going to direct a Martin Luther King biopic.
I have heard that too.
Okay. And Adrian Warren, who took a couple days off from giving a Tony-winning performance to come be in your...
Not a couple film. Of days off. She's doing 8 shows a week.
Right.
Monday is her day off on Broadway. She comes to Pittsburgh, which is where we filmed, films her 2 scenes, and then goes back so she can resume her 8 performances a week schedule.
Wow. Well, that says as much about you as it does about her. She really, to go and do that for someone means you, you know.
No, I adore her. I adore her.
Okay, so bottom line, many people who are going to come across this movie on Netflix or elsewhere may look at the title and have no idea what Rustin is. They watch the movie. It's a learning, entertaining experience. What is it, though, that you would hope they leave the experience of seeing this movie, you know, thinking, doing? What's the main takeaway you hope there is from this?
Well, I'm obsessed with, and it, once again, it, this started around the museum. I'm obsessed with or even though Bayer doesn't completely fit this category, particularly after you learn more about it, but I'm really obsessed with ordinary people doing extraordinary things. And by virtue of doing these extraordinary things, become extraordinary themselves. And so every single thing that I do or work on, I want it to be an event of empowerment. Not rah, 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 I'm so happy empowerment, but a confidence and a depth of understanding about that they are capable of wondrous things. And that's what, and I think he knew that he was capable of wondrous things, but also seeing him work with these young kids and empower them and going, no, 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 dig deeper, be smarter, be braver. There's a smarter answer, pushing them and pushing them and pushing them. So I hope that they come away with a sense of that. That sense that, once again, that activism is a verb. So therefore, it's about the organizing. It's about the planning. It's about the thinking. It's about the doing. So claim the title all you want, but do the hard work too. So that's very, very important to me. And you see an example that you see these people pull off this miraculous event. They pulled it off. One of the most moving sequences of in my mind, and it comes from doing theater and film, is when you see those trucks pull up past the Lincoln Memorial, and you go, oh my God, I've actually pulled this shit off. That's just the miracle of that. The miracle of when the collective is focused and driven, what it's capable of. So that's some of the things that I want them to carry away.
Well, on behalf of everybody, thank you so much for the great work on stage, screen, and for being here tonight. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to Awards Chatter. We really appreciate it and would really appreciate you taking just a minute more to subscribe to the podcast and to leave us a rating and review on your podcast app. And to follow us on Twitter and Instagram, where our handle is @AwardsChatter. On those platforms, we announce upcoming guests and provide details about special live recordings of the podcast that you can attend. Until next time, thanks again for tuning in.